recording?
Yeah.
They just turned the music down.
All right, it's September 1st, 1988, and we have with us Tuffy Hampton. Can you say your name, Tuffy?
Tuffy Hampton.
Okay, and where were you born, Tuffy?
Miami, Florida.
And, anyway, what is your permanent address, or when were you born?
You know, on Valentine's Day in 1957.
That's February 14th?
Uh-huh.
57?
That's right.
I'm September 12th, 57.
We're going to shake hands now for record of the tape. And the brother shake.
And,
you're September 57.
Yes. Yeah. What is your permanent address?
My permanent address is a post office box 24712 in Fort Lauderdale. It's a small place, but I call it home. 33307. But I'm usually listed in whichever city I'm living.
Post office box in Miami?
Fort Lauderdale.
Fort Lauderdale.
Yeah, I was born in Miami. I lived there for 12 years. Then I moved to Columbus, Ohio, and lived there for 12 years. Now I'm home.
Okay, this what this tape is for is I'm doing a book called Attic, and I'm going to have your picture on one page and then your story on the other page. Maybe more than one page. We're trying to keep it just to one page, but a lot of people have been talking for 9 minutes. And I'm hoping to do about 50 people in this book. And what I want you to do is talk about your growing up, the pain, your spiritual path today.
Growing up, some your spiritual path today.
Some bizarre things that happened to you. something that you think would be important to go along with your photograph for other people to read.
I sold my old lady once for $45.
All right,
to pay the electric bill.
All right, you can mention that. And it's basically a book of hope and how we're all pretty much the same, and you know, maybe someone will identify with your story more than someone shooting in a neck or something, you know?
Today when I sell my old lady, I get $154. There is hope.
All right.
So
basically, you understand what your page is about. It can be whatever you want, whatever you say on this tape. But it's
going to
be edited.
Yeah, the whole book sounds kind of like if that's all the book is, you should have more in the book. No one will buy it. That's boring. Picture after story after picture after story.
Well, you don't know what my pictures look like, and you don't know what's going to come out when you start talking.
That's true. Okay. Now I talk.
You would. It's been an amazing time hearing all these people share. Amazing. I've been getting the best recovery possible just in my own way.
Let other people critique it too and listen and see the book and stuff.
Alright, your job now is just to talk. Your life.
I had an exciting
life. What's
important
about Tuffy?
Oh man, what's important about me is having fun. But now I'm 31 and it's time to grow up and be responsible, even though I did come here with no money. Which I do usually anyway, go to conventions with no money. Let's see, I was growing up, I was a happy boy. I'm a Dr. Spock baby. There's a bunch of us like that in this generation now. And I don't really know what growing up was like. I don't really remember a lot. But to give you a quick rundown, let's see, my mom met my dad. He was in the service in Opa-locka, Florida. A little town in Miami, sort of. And I don't really remember my dad much at all. My mom married my stepdad when I was 3. My real dad came and visited me when I was 12. Spent a week with me, or a weekend. It was different. It was weird. I don't remember really much about it. He didn't really seem like my dad, but he's a salesman. I've been wanting to look him up here lately now. I don't know where he's living or what he's doing. But so she married my stepdad. And well, I called my mother by her first name until I was 3, and then he said, no more this, I'm dad, and she's mom, and that's how it's going to be, and that's how it was. And but they couldn't stay married, off and on. He lived in Philadelphia. So it got to one point in my life, I remember, that every year we would go to Philadelphia. They'd try to get back together, from Miami to Philadelphia, and then it didn't work. We'd end up back in Florida. And we did that so much that one year the Catholic school I went to made a rule just for me that if you left during the school year, you couldn't re-enroll during that same school year. And sure enough, that same year we did it again and it didn't work out. We ended up back home in Florida. So, I haven't had much of a father figure. I get my father figure maybe from either movies or my peers when I was a teenager. Or this one guy, my mom's boyfriend, she had for a while. He was a swarthy kind of fellow, a real man, a man's man. He wasn't a badass, but he took no shit from no one. And he was very sure of himself, confident, and I learned a lot from that man in that short time. But, you know, I grew up relatively normal, and one year when my mom and dad tried to get back together in Philly, and it didn't work. We were on our way back to Florida. We stopped in Columbus, Ohio in July of 70 just to visit some relatives. My mother was born there, and I come from Italian descent. Stopped there to visit some relatives, and it was really nice. We got off the train in July of 70, and it was cool. Now, you don't have cool nights in July in Florida. And my mom said, yeah, this is great. Maybe we'll stay the rest of the summer or something. If I get a job, we'll just, you know, we'll hang out for the next 4 to 6 weeks or whatever, and then head back home. And, you know, fall was approaching. It's getting time for school. Well, she did get a job, and we did stay a while. She said, well, if we get a place to live, we'll stay for the school year. We'll stay in Ohio. So we stayed for 12 years or thereabouts. I finally moved back to Florida in 82 in December. And Florida's home. But in Ohio is where I learned how to party and where I found recovery from addiction also. But I'm getting a little ahead of the story because I was coming down to Florida to visit some friends. And I wasn't exposed to any drugs. In any form, that includes alcohol, when I was in Ohio, other than maybe trying to drink, but I'd never gotten off before, never gotten a buzz. I was visiting in Florida, and my friends down here were already partying, so I was in a group of guys, they broke out a joint, and they started passing it around the circle. Must have been 12 of us there, and it was scary. It was a joint just like what you'd see on TV, you know, rolled in yellow rolling paper, real tiny, real small. And they passed it around, and I was scared. I thought, what am I going to say to these guys? How am I going to get out of this? What am I going to do? The joint comes to me, and I say, oh, no, man. I'm off that shit now. They laughed and said, what are you talking about? I said, yeah, I was real addicted to that shit, man. I might have even told them I went to treatment or something. They said, get out, you know. I couldn't even smoke cigarettes at this time. I was 15 years old. I'm a cigarette smoker now. I have been since I was 16. But I took a hit off the joint, and I didn't get off. I didn't get high, but I did get cool. I was cool now. I came back home to Columbus, told all my buddies, hey man, I smoked some pot while I was down there, and coincidentally enough, so did some of my buddies in Columbus while I was away. They had smoked some pot or experimented with drugs. And so I guess you'd call that the experimental stage where there are, yeah, I smoked pot, but I would never do acid, let's say, right? Then a friend of mine, he had a hit of acid, hit a window pane. Chris, you got a message over there. I mean, your thing is flashing. Did you tell me why it was flashing? So friend of mine, you know, that was the line. I drew the line right there. Yeah, I'll smoke pot, but I'll never do LSD because I didn't want to smoke the joint because I knew marijuana smoke led to heroin addiction. I saw it on all the television shows. They laughed at me, of course, but I took the hit anyway. I was cool, and I was up in Ohio. My buddy had a hit of acid. I wasn't going to do acid because it was made of LSD, and I knew if you did LSD, you could take an acid trip 25 years later and jump out the window. That's what they told us, and I believed what the media and society had programmed into me. I really don't believe that today, that I'm going to go on another acid trip sometime in the future and fly out the window or off the roof of the Hilton. Nonetheless, my buddy brought in a hit of acid, some window pane, and it was so tiny. And he cut it in half. We're going to split it. And I said, that little thing, I'm going to get off on that. He said, yeah. And I ate it, and I was tripping my brains out. That's pretty neat. So I've done acid now, right, and smoked pot. But I'll never shoot drugs. I'd never stick a needle in my arm. So I drew the line a little further. Sure enough, I was at a friend's house. They broke out some more liquid morphine, you know. But let me point out, the drugs are not important, what drugs I used. I used because my friends were using. It was just the society. And I wanted to be accepted and be cool. And my buddy, he turned me on the acid. He was also the first guy I shot dope with. We drew up some liquid morphine, and he did it for the first time. He got off instantly like that. I said, you can't be off now. He said, yeah, man, it's great, tough. You ought to try it. And I did, and I was off like that. And it was great. So from then on, there wasn't anything I wouldn't do and anything I wouldn't try. If it was a new buzz or a new drug, I'd try it. So I'm moving through the experimental stage into the... and my first time I got drunk, I was 17. I learned how to drink. I learned that after the first... And it was beer, right? The first couple beers, they were nasty, right? But after about three beers, you get that alcohol buzz going. And then the rest of them just flow right down, you know? And you get a real numb feeling, and I liked it. And I was working with some hillbillies at some truss company, building trusses for houses. At a Christmas party, and 17, I got drunk the first time. I threw up, too. It was terrible. What a buzz. I drove home, too. You know, throughout my entire addiction, I could have been killed many times. I did some pretty crazy shit. Anyway, my addiction takes off, and I'm using, and I'm working, and I'm using drugs in all forms. There isn't anything I won't do. But I didn't become a heroin junkie. I drank a lot, smoked a lot of pot, and I did whatever recreational drugs I could get my hands on, really, but it cost money. I never was a successful dealer. So I didn't, I didn't make a lot of money at it. I just would try my hand at it just to cover the cost of using drugs. So anyway, I was a construction worker. I got a job doing construction work in Columbus, and I was never really a business-minded person, but I do have entrepreneurial thinking, and I didn't ever really realize it, but I was always wanting to have my own business or wanting to make money or just, but I'd rather party than do anything. After I found out what using was like, my whole life and thinking was centered in drugs in one form or another, you know, the getting and using and finding ways and means to get more. There were times when I, you know, when my stash would get low, it was time to cop. When I was out, I was desperate, and we had to have something around the house. So, like I said, I was working for a construction. I was doing some construction work, some drywall work, and I was a hard worker. I worked for one company, and sometimes the work got to the point where I needed a helper. So, I used this guy for a while as a helper, and then there just wasn't enough work to keep us both busy. I acquired another company. So now the two of us are doing work for two companies, and eventually, I was doing work for three companies with two helpers, and I could see where I was starting a business, and I could have eventually had a monopoly in the Central Ohio area for what I did in drywall. But I did like to party, and I did use a lot, and that became pretty much more important than working. My work took a back seat. I would show up late for work. I worked on like a production line system of new home construction, whereas I had to do my job. The next people would get in there and do their job. You got painters and carpenters and carpet layers and plumbers, and everybody's got their turn to get in there. It's production. So I was kind of holding up the works, and I got fired from one of my companies. That was okay. I had two other companies, and I was going to keep working for them. I lost them both. By this time, I had learned about credit and signing my name. I had an old lady that lived with me for 5 years. She had two kids. I played dad to them, and that kept my using down to a minimum because I had some responsibilities. I had truck payments. I had my mortgage payment, and I bought a washer and a dryer and a refrigerator and, well, anything else I could sign for and not be able to pay for. So I started losing everything. I lost the house. I lost the truck. I lost my wife and lost the kids. I lost my employment from all three places. I ended up living at my mother's. I was like 23, 24 years old. Living at my mother's, was fortunate enough to collect unemployment, and I just started to learn how to live then. I found recovery. There's plenty of self-help groups and 12-step fellowships that offer recovery, and that's how I found recovery. I didn't go through any kind of treatment or rehabilitation or detox or anything like that. Just through the self-help groups, which are offered in various communities, is how I found help. I went to these meetings, couldn't really relate to anybody at first, but they had a lot of fun, and that's what I said at the beginning, that I love to party, I love to have fun. I'm about partying, enjoying life, and having a lot of fun. So, some of the people were fun to hang around with. I just started having fun and kept coming to meetings. After a while, I heard something that I related to. When I came in and saw a bunch of addicts that were trying to stay clean, I looked at them, I said, they can't. They didn't party like I partied. People that partied where I came from, they didn't get clean. They died. They ended up in jail. A guy in our neighborhood, he killed his girlfriend. You know, I mean, premeditated. Strangled her, raped her, burned her car up, killed her dead. Told people about it. His father shot himself, killed himself. I had another guy. We had another guy. This chick was breaking into someone's house. They were in there waiting for her, and they blew her away with a shotgun. I had another friend of mine get killed in a car accident. They came over to my house and used my cooler, and they went out cruising that night, and they wanted to take me with them, and I wasn't going to go. There were four guys in a Volkswagen with my cooler. That's like, there wasn't any room for me. They went out, and they got in a wreck, and one of them died that night. And another guy cruising down Westerville Road, semi-truck was out in the middle of the street backing out from a driveway or a store or something. He went right underneath it, cut off the top of his roof and his head, and he was dead. And I was really kind of glad for that. He was a dick anyway. But so that's the kind of neighborhood I come from, and people just didn't stop using and didn't get responsible. I mean, we got married and had kids and shit, but we did not recover. We still use, and sometimes when you have forced responsibilities like a wife and kids, your using is somewhat limited and your weekends out are somewhat limited. But nonetheless, I was coming to these rooms of recovery, I'll call them, and I thought these people were real lightweights and wimps and didn't know how to party anyway, but something started to click. What I did was I just kept coming around. I didn't want to stop using. I didn't want to recover. But something attracted me. It must have been the fun everyone was having. We would go out after meetings to coffee shops and restaurants, and it was just really crazy. And I didn't think these people were like, I thought life without using was really quite boring. But these people were having fun. They had functions and dances and social gatherings and activities of which I participated. And I enjoyed. I enjoyed them. I had fun. So I kept coming around and something clicked. I got a higher power that is spoke of in meetings. See, this isn't a religious, these self-help groups I went to. They're not like religious things at all. But they are based on spiritual principles. Though we're each free to find our own higher power, our own concept of whatever spiritual fulfillment we get from. So I latched on to something similar yet different from my preconceived notions of religion. I was raised a Catholic boy. And it got to the point where I was coming to these meetings. I was still using. I was smoking pot. My smoking had gotten, my drug usage had gotten limited. I already quit drinking. I quit doing hallucinogenics. And I would only shoot dope if it was like something really special. But I gave up acid. I tried to just quit shooting dope. But as I'm coming to these meetings and I'm still using all the time, and I would do a couple bong hits. I was just smoking pot. And I would meditate. I'd have my higher power. I'd call on God. I'd do a couple bong hits, and I would, you know, like the Indians would do. I thought the Indians were really cool, really spiritual. You know, they do their peyote, and they touch God. They touch the spirit. Everything to them was the spirit. And I felt Indian. I felt, I'm not Italian. I don't have any Italian blood. I'm Indian. I know what I am. And people would say, Tuffy, how do you know you're Indian? You say, an Indian knows when he's an Indian. And, but I would do this, and I would meditate, and I would try and find God's will for me. I figured there must be a plan, you know. Kept coming to meetings, kept doing bong hits, kept meditating. Sooner or later, I figured, well, you know, my higher power probably wants me to stay clean for a while and help some of these fools recover, because they were having a hard time of it. The meetings in my area, there's only like three of them a week. This was like in 81. Then I figured maybe I could start some meetings. You know, they need me. These people need me. So I did. I started a couple meetings while I was still using. And by the time these meetings started, I was really clean. I had to lie. I had to cop to a clean date sooner or later. No one used to ask me. But then after a while, people started asking me. My mother asked me. I was living with my mother, and the condition was that I'd be totally abstinent to live there from all drugs. And so I gave my mother a clean date. I just picked it off the calendar in the kitchen. And going to these meetings, people start asking me, how long are you clean, Tuff? I'd say, oh, a month. Oh, 6 weeks. 2 months. 10 weeks. This lie every day kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and I was still doing my bong hits every night and meditating. I've started 2 meetings. I'm almost 4 months on this lie. How much you clean? I had almost 4 months of this lie going when I really never had a day. And I'm gaining respect in this program, this fellowship of which I belong. And then, finally, one day, I get clean. I through, you know, my higher power, I figured God wants me to be clean to help these fools out for a while. Then I could go back to using. Maybe a week, maybe a month. It wasn't permanent. I didn't have to stay clean forever because pot was okay. I just had to stop drinking because alcohol was a very serious drug. I mean, it made me do things I didn't want to do. It turned me into the kind of person which I really wasn't. But pot was okay. So I say to God, sure, I'll stop using for a while and help out the situation. So I'm really clean. I'm really clean now. And I can't tell anybody. I mean, everybody thought I was clean. 4 months, right? And I've got a week, and I'm really excited about this. I've never had a week before since I started using, and I got a week, and I'm proud of it, and I can't tell anybody. What a feeling, right? I didn't have some of the suggestions, like get a sponsor, which is someone that guides you through the steps. Let's say a mentor that guides you through the process of recovery, and I didn't have that until I was really clean. So this guy, he came to share his story at one of our evening meetings that we have, and he was good. He covered all points about recovery, about it's a 12-step fellowship. He covered all points about the steps, about sponsorship, about regular attendance at meetings. And I asked him to be my sponsor. He said sure he would, and I had to tell him. It was tough telling him, but I told him the events that came about me getting clean. It had to do with my dogs getting loose. And it was a spiritual awakening for me, which to someone else would not have been anything. But it was what I understood as my higher power talking to me. I told my sponsor this story. I didn't tell him that these events took place last week. I just told him the story that got me clean. He said, okay. And we go out for a bite to eat at the restaurant where my ex-old lady was working. And she's talking, you know, how's everything? Fine. How's everything going? Fine. She says, how's the dogs? I say, oh, they're fine. I say, they got out last week, but I caught them and they got back in, no harm done. And then I realized, I looked at my sponsor. I said, oh, shit, I just realized something. He said, yeah, me too. We got to talk. So now my sponsor knows I'm only clean a week, and that's really a relief. He says, you know what you got to do, don't you? I said, tell my mother. Because, you know, I figured I'd get kicked out, but that's okay. I had faith in my higher power. I trusted God that, so what if I get kicked out? I sleep in the truck, you know, no big deal. Everything will be all right. He said, you know what you got to do, right? I said, tell my mother. He said, yeah, and tell the fellowship. I said, oh, shit, man, I don't want to do this shit. So these meetings I started 3 weeks ago, I planned them to begin in 3 weeks. So here it is, I'm a week clean. These meetings are getting ready to start. It was like, we'd already had the Wednesday meeting. He was the speaker at the first meeting. It was a Friday meeting, and I had to tell the fellowship. The fellowship couldn't have been more than 20 people at that time, and I expected 5 to show up at the meeting. We had like 25 people at that meeting. I knew 23 of them, and 2 of them were newcomers. I don't even know how they found this place or knew there was a meeting there because it was the first night of the meeting. So I start the meeting, I ask anybody have a topic of recovery they want to talk about, or a problem. Nobody did, and everybody looked at me, so I had to talk about it. So I told them. I said, well, I got something to say. I said, I'm not really clean almost 4 months. I got a week clean. And I copped to the, and there was like silence fell over the room. And I talked about it, I said whatever I said. I don't remember what was said other than I remember I copped to it. And I remember how humiliating. Of course, this is a program of, you know, humility, of being humble and building your character through spiritual principles, through working the steps I mentioned before. And we shared about it at that time. The 1 hour meeting lasted, I think, 2 hours? An hour and a half, 2.5 hours? I don't know. It was almost 7 years ago. So that was in November 1981. So then I told my mother. She ended up not kicking me out. I ended up getting to stay there, and so started my recovery and my spiritual awareness. And so my life got better. or else I would use, and now I can go out and use it any time I want because I didn't, I don't have to stay clean. I choose to stay clean. When I was using, I did not have a choice. I used every day. And I thought I had a choice, though I didn't really. I used every day. And when I thought I could go a day without using, by the end of the day, I thought, well, why am I doing this? And I used. I smoked a joint, and I, you know, keeping total abstinence in the beginning wasn't easy, and I didn't have a reason, but when I got a higher power, I had a reason. It was only something I was going to do temporarily, and then I could go back to using and you know, just go on about my life, but I never really wanted to do that. I just kept helping out this fellowship. I kept getting involved, and you know what happened? I made friends. I had real feelings of love, acceptance, joy, happiness, belonging. My character—I was not as insecure as I was when I was using. I had confidence, self-esteem. That's what I got. I got self-esteem. Something I never really had. I didn't really feel that good about myself really much. I hung around a lot of other, you know, a lot of older people maybe, or people that were more cocky or that I looked up to. I rarely hung around anyone that looked up to me. So naturally, I had no self-esteem. Anyway, like I said, so this program, Narcotics Anonymous, has given me a life not only better than the hell I once lived, but better than any life I've ever known. Even when I was a kid and having fun and playing and riding my bicycle, this fellowship, I said, give me a sense of belonging. And the principles are, you got to give it away to keep it. And I'm not selfish anymore. I'm more selfless. I give much more than I ever did before. I don't have that feeling of if I give it away, I'm going to lose it. The only way I can keep what I have is by giving it away, by helping another addict stay clean another day. That is why I'm here. This fellowship has 12 traditions which govern it. They literally govern it. The 12 traditions are not negotiable. They are the guidelines that keep our fellowship alive and free. The fifth tradition states that each group has but one primary purpose, and that's to carry the message of recovery to the addict that still suffers. You see, without newcomers, we don't grow. We die. We all grow old and we die. This fellowship doesn't get any bigger, and eventually we all die off. But we have newcomers coming in all the time, people that want to stop using, people that are curious, people that don't know if they have a problem but think they might. And they come around, they sit in here, they feel the love, the acceptance that we have, the empathy, that feeling of recognition, wordless recognition, that you can only get from another addict. Just like it says in our literature, we feel that our approach to the disease of addiction is completely realistic. You know what? The therapeutic value of one addict helping another, it's without parallel. Nothing comes close to one addict helping another, because one addict can best understand and help another addict. You've got one addict that's recovering, that's been a practicing addict, but has found recovery through the practice and application of Narcotics Anonymous. Nothing else seems to have worked. This is a just for today program. I stay clean just for today. I'm not here to, you know, be clean forever, but I probably will. I mentioned the traditions. There's also the tradition. See, like, you know why it's an anonymous fellowship? Because we can't say we're an NA and we're not using, because you know what? It's a disease. It's a chronic and progressive disease. I could relapse. I could go out there and use. And you know what would cause that? Lack of maintenance of my program. Maybe I'd stop going to meetings. Maybe I'd stop praying. I pray every day. I have my spirit. I have my beliefs. And I keep that conscious contact alive. And sometimes it gets cloudy. And sometimes it's very alive and very clear. And it shines through. And it's just, there's just like a real connection sometimes. Where other times, it's like a bad connection. It's like, what? I can hardly hear you. Speak up. And sometimes it's like wordless recognition. I was going to say something about spiritual principles, about this program. What I was going to say is that there's one thing more than anything else that will defeat us in our recovery, and we can be defeated. This is not a guaranteed plan other than, well, anyway, the one thing more than anything else, that's an attitude of indifference or intolerance towards spiritual principles. And I was saying that these things, if you don't maintain your program, sure, you could use again. That's what I did all my life. It's escape, get that buzz, that feeling of euphoria, you know, trip out into another land, just feel kind of numb, but I have to go to meetings, I have to help another addict stay clean another day, and I'm rewarded through this. I feel good about myself, I feel happy, I enjoy life. Otherwise, if I stop going to meetings, let's say I stop praying, let's say I just start getting kind of negative, I get kind of shitty, my attitude, my level of acceptance goes out the fucking window. Take traffic, take elevators, take standing in lines, for instance. These are good examples, right? It doesn't bother me to stand in line, although sometimes traffic still bothers me. If I know there's a lane I can get in, I'd rather be in that lane than sitting behind these people in front of me. You know, there's nothing like... You can't work a perfect program because, well, I'm not perfect. I'm human. I have human emotions, human desires, human defects of character. Through working the steps, I try and rid my character of these defects. These defects that burden my spiritual growth. I want to grow spiritually. I want to be respected. I want to have self-esteem. And you know how I get that? I get that through working these steps. This is how I build my character. This is how I love myself. And I really do love myself. I live alone now. I love my apartment. I cherish my solitude. I cherish it. Or do I treasure my solitude? Nah, I cherish it. I love being in my apartment alone, especially when the TV is off, the radio is off, and sometimes when the lights are off. And the only light might be from the moon, you know? Might be from, well, that's about the only thing. Maybe the street light shines in the window, but sometimes it's really, really quiet, and I'm alone with myself. Damn, that feels so fucking good. And I don't know how it would feel before. Maybe I would feel bored. You know what? I'm never bored anymore. I can't understand people say, man, I'm so fucking bored. I'm like, well, maybe you're so fucking boring. I don't know. I am rarely bored unless I am with someone who is boring me. I'm in a controlled situation. I don't know. Recovery is really good, and I enjoy it today. Of course, I maintain it. I still go to meetings. I still help another addict stay clean another day. What a feeling that is. What a feeling when a newcomer, his eyes are wide open, you know, and he wants what you have to offer, and he's willing to make the effort to get it. In other words, he's ready to take certain steps. He's ready, you know, these steps, these are the principles that made my recovery possible. You know where I got them from? I got them from the guy that came in here before I did. And you know where he got them from? From someone else. And that someone else got to keep what they had by giving it away. And my sponsor got to keep what he had. He gave it to me. And I give it to other people. Not everybody stays. Some people would rather use. And you know what? They're miserable. Every single motherfucking one of them that goes out there and uses, without exception, well, that's a pretty absolute statement, without exception. Every addict I've known that's gone back out there and used has not been as happy as he's been in here in recovery. And something else I was going to say about using and about recovering, about being in, about being out, people that come back, people do go out and use, but they come, and many of them come back. I say, why'd you come back? They give me the strangest look, and they say, well, because it didn't get any better out there, man. It fucking got worse. And I say, you know, thanks. I need to hear that. Since I got clean, I've never relapsed. I've never picked up another drug. There have been times, I tell you, when my disease was full-blown, and I was angry. I was, like, pissed off. Angry's not the word. I was negative. I was very, my defects were glaring, but I didn't pick up. See, my priorities in life are, first, to stay clean. Two, to recover. Number one, I stay clean. Number two, I recover. Because, first of all, I have to be clean to be recovering. And sometimes all I am is clean. Sometimes I can get into an emotional situation where my feelings really come out, my program goes out the fucking window. Acceptance? I don't want no fucking acceptance. I want to kill the fucking bitch, okay? I'm so pissed off sometimes. It's usually in relationships where my emotions get so exposed, I guess is the word. My raw nerve endings are out there. I guess that's when I'm most vulnerable, and that's when I'm most susceptible to pain. But let me tell you, I have felt some serious pain in recovery, unlike anything I've ever felt, emotional pain, when I was using. Of course, I felt some joy in recovery, unparalleled to any joy or feelings of happiness I ever felt when I was using. Indescribable joy. I guess that's the best way I could describe it. It's indescribable. So I stick around. So I stay. I love this fellowship. I love what I have to offer. There are times when I could keep on talking and talking and talking. I am at a convention. I am at a celebration of my recovery right now. And I feel like, you know, I've been in here over an hour. And I am missing the convention, the celebration. Of course, maybe this will do some good. And maybe, I don't know, I love talking about myself. I love talking about Narcotics Anonymous. I fucking love this fellowship with a passion. I love it with my life. I love it with my soul. I love it with my recovery. So my recovery is very important to me. So, kind of like running out of things to say. Now I fucking remember the most important thing I wanted to say. How can anything be the most important thing? Everything is just so intertwined with the other thing. But I have never seen this program fail with anyone who has worked it. This program has never failed to work with anyone. Never, never, never. Now that's an absolute. That's what I wanted to say. This program works for those who try it and work it. You come to meetings regularly, it's going to start working. You work steps in your life, it's going to work for you. You help another addict stay clean, and it's going to work for you. These are the principles that made our recovery possible. If you don't do these things, well, no wonder you're out there fucking using again. Because we told you, we give you these tools when you come in, and we laid them down for you. We said, here, here's your tools, work them. They're steps, they're, you know, helping another addict stay clean, and they are going to meetings regularly. You know, they are getting a sponsor. This is it. It's real fucking simple. So we give them to you. Do you use them? No, you don't use them. And you're out there wondering. You say, the program didn't work? No, no, no. You fool. The program works. You didn't work it. This program has never failed anyone who has ever worked it. Ask anyone that works it.